This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. One of the most anticipated sequels this year is a story of a violent alien race attacking planet Earth.
This is Fleet Admiral Harper. We are engaging the enemy.
Negative, Admiral. Form a defensive perimeter around the cluster.
Something's not right. The fleet that destroyed Reach was 50 times this size.
Sir, additional contacts. Boarding craft and lots of them.
They're going to try to take our MAC guns offline. Give their capital ships a straight shot at Earth. Master Chief, defend this station.
Yes, sir. I need a weapon.
Right this way.
It's not in the theaters. It's not a groundbreaking HBO production. It's Halo 2, Microsoft's latest offering for the Xbox video game console. It was released last week and has already made $100 million. Video or electronic games have long stopped being just for kids. The game's technology and sophistication have grown up along with a generation of kids who started playing Nintendo back in the 1980s. The average age of game players today is 29, according to the Entertainment Software Association. Today's games entice players with elaborate storylines enhanced by action you can not only see and hear, but feel. Another sign of its coming of age is the amount of money it generates. The electronic game industry has made $10 billion last year, as opposed to Hollywood's mere $9.5 billion. A look at the video game industry in this hour of Talk of the Nation. Are you hooked on video games? What's your number one game at the moment? Are you playing it right at this minute? Come on. Tell us if you are. You can pause it and give us a call. Our number here is in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Chris Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired and an avid gamer. He joins us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Joe. Nice to be here.
So we meet again.
Indeed.
Have you tried Halo 2?
Have I tried Halo 2? Well, Christmas came early this year. I was very fortunate due to, of course, my privileged position to get Halo a few days before the other kids on the block. And my son and I, my seven-year-old and I, have been playing it, on weekends, of course, no school nights. And it's fantastic.
How old is your son?
So, well, my oldest, my seven-year-old.
Oh, okay.
I know, I'm a really bad
father.
Quite violent.
Well, all right. So, quickly, do you think it lives up to the marketing?
I do. Well, first of all, it lives up to the standards set by Halo 1, which we finished. It's transcendent. It is the best game I've ever played. And the marketing, I think it does. It's... games these days, it's quite extraordinary that, that a kind of a middle-aged guy like me and his seven-year-old son can play pretty much as equals. And I think that's a testament to its kind of balance and, kind of fairness. And
I think it's a testament to your youthfulness, Chris, because seven-year-olds usually wipe out their aging parents.
Well, basically, we play in cooperative mode, which means that I go in, get sort of shot to pieces, and he kind of mops up afterwards.
I got it. Well, we're trying something here. I've got a Xbox console in front of me, and I've got a video monitor, which I can assure our listeners is typically turned to some important news event, but today it's got the controls. Now, Chris, I don't know if you know this about me, but I am not a game player at all, and I'm all thumbs, but I'm going to try this as a newbie. And first of all, so I've got this console, I've got my both hands on it, it's got a bunch of buttons and knobs and things like this, but I'm going to try, I'm at the screen, I think I'm at a right place, so I'm going to press continue, and okay, now I see I'm in a there's shots firing across the screen. I'm going for and now when I pull the trigger, it's the gun flashes and I'm shooting at something, and this is good. And but have I been killed? No, I still seem to be alive, but I don't see anybody. Chris, how do you find people in this game?
Well,
I mean, I'm traveling. I'm walking into somebody just bumped into there. I think I just shot myself in the foot. Well, that's happened before. So you can't just walk in. I mean, one of the things about this... Oh, I got him, but I was standing on top of him. No, I think he got me. All right, I'm dead. Game over. How do you get any... I mean, how long do you, before you can even do anything in that game?
Not that long, actually. I mean, all games these days have what they call a learning curve, where they try to kind of ease you in gently. And, it sometimes it'll be like a an obstacle course that you try, or a very simple mission where they kind of walk you through the steps. It's actually, had you given it another 10 seconds, you probably would have maybe killed a Covenant, an alien. But it is despite the fact that you will get the hang of it, that is not to say that you will not get completely slaughtered were you to go out and play 7-year-olds, for instance.
Right.
But, it is fast twitch.
But I watched the introduction to this, and there is a very elaborate scene, and you're in some, alien futuristic legislature, and you're a courtroom, and they're taking a commander, and they're chastising him. It's all very elaborate. And then you get to the game, and it's basically bang, bang, shoot him up. I mean, what's all the production about? Is there really a story, or is it just, shoot the aliens, kill,
sure,
win a prize?
Well, the what's happened in the 20 years since Space Invaders is that, that it's a bit of a cliche, but it's true that Hollywood and the games industry are converging. And what that means is not just the visuals, that the games sort of look more and more like movies. And if you look at a football game from across a room, you can't actually tell right now. It's not easy to tell whether it is a real live football game or a video
you
game.
You mean one of the video game football
one,
games.
One of the
yeah.
video game, uh-huh. sorry, the game ambiguity.
Yeah.
Forgive me. Yeah, so like Madden 2005 or something, one of those. So visually they look more like each other. And as a result, they now have the capacity to introduce things like story and character and plot development. And what you're seeing right now is voice acting that's kind of at Hollywood levels. There's the computer graphics and special effects often use the same techniques and same people as Hollywood movies do. And now you're even the technology is so good that the face animation is starting to actually follow the speech. And now they have all the tools at their disposal to tell stories, they're starting to actually do so.
Huh? Is the game still something that you have to play on your own, or you mentioned that you play with your son? I mean, is it limited to two players, or are more people getting in on this at a time?
And that's the other big change. So it's always been possible to play, head to head with somebody on originally in the arcades. But these days, for example, my son and I would play in what we call a split screen, which is basically Halo is what they call a first person shooter, which is your vantage is inside the head of your character. And what they do is they split the screen, and his character's on the top and my character's on the bottom, and he can see me and I can see him and I can see my own hand, and we can all see the aliens, and we kind of work together as a team. We talk it through, and it's very, very kind of collaborative. The big new trend, however, is to merge this with online. So on the back of the Xbox console is a little Ethernet jack, and you can plug that into your network and your cable modem or DSL, and you can play against anybody in the world. And this is amazing in that you get kind of much smarter opponents. I mean, as good as the artificial intelligence is in these games, real people are still better. So the quality of kind of your competitor is much better. The problem is, of course, that they're incredibly good. And I feel quite good after I defeat a level and beat some Covenant, and then I go online and just get my head handed to me. So you got to brace yourself to go out into the wild world of true gamers.
All right, apparently so. I'm feeling great trepidation, but maybe it'll save me some money. All right,
that's why they had easy mode.
I see. Yeah, easy mode was where I was getting slaughtered, Chris. We have two email comments here. First, let me read one from Ray. Who doesn't give his address. But anyway, he says, I am very excited to hear a discussion on video games. I am a PC game addict. Half-Life 2 comes out today, and I'm very excited about that. The most popular multiplayer game on the internet was made by the makers of Half-Life. The game is Counter-Strike. I know Halo and Doom 3 will be getting a lot of press, but I believe Counter-Strike is arguably the most influential internet game ever, including huge gaming leagues, much like bowling leagues. There are both amateur and pro leagues. Well, Chris, do you know anything at all about Counter-Strike?
It's another place where I get my head handed to me.
Uh-huh.
Counter-Strike is really an interesting example, which is that it's kind of an organic growth. So what you have is the consoles and the PC games, and the first generation was kind of you play against the machine. And then, you know, starting with you know, the first Dooms and Quakes, those gamers who had broadband connections would sort of play against each other online. And then the game makers decided this was kind of an organic community, and they would just let them do it on their own. And they provided tools to allow them to design their own games, really, their own levels, their own enemies, you know, around these kind of existing, you know, software frameworks. And Counter-Strike was an example of that. And you know, it was originally, you know, launched by Valve, which is the maker of Half-Life, but it's really taken on a life of its own. And the vibrancy of that community, the millions of people who are out there playing, you know, every day, online, is just something that it's been a wake-up call to the industry, and which is why you're seeing so many companies now getting into what they call massively multiplayer or online gaming as the big new growth area.
I'm wondering if there are any games that are more, you know, leaving behind some of the fast twitch, I think you call them, the pull-the-trigger kind of mode, and more toward the, you know, for want of a better word, a treasure hunt, or, you know, or a strategy game where you're trying to take over the world you know, world domination, but not through being particularly smart about shooting at people, but just trading in sugar as opposed to coffee beans or something like that.
Well, there's all kinds, and what you're seeing is that you're seeing sort of clean divisions of the demographics for each kind of game. So the main categories are this. We just talked about first-person shooters, which are kind of action-oriented and tend to be a little violent. Then there's sports games, which are, you know, quite amazing, you know, simulations and replications of football and basketball and soccer and any sport you can consider. Then there's things like racing games, which are very popular and, you know, are great fun. We do a lot of that. Then there's the kind of more slower, less fast twitchy games, and some of them are what they call real-time strategy, where you kind of look down at a battlefield and you pretend to be a general. And these, you know, start with the kind of what they call the god games, which are originally things like you know, like Sim City, where you're kind of, you know, you're building a city, to ones where you actually do sort of, you know, do wage world war, but kind of division by division, moving things around with a pointer. And then there are finally, there are still the kind of more slower exploratory games, like the Myst was the original one. They're still making Myst, and those tend to be more popular with adults. And you know, the most popular with the kind of the older generation, the 40 plus, are the very detailed simulations like flight simulators, which are still played mostly on PCs.
Yes, if your PC has enough muscle. Well, anyway, I have another email here from Stephanie in Ann Arbor, Michigan, who writes, "Right now I am playing," she says in quotes, "Yourself Fitness on the Xbox. It's a workout game, actually more of a personal trainer. There are 500 exercises for the upper body, lower body, yoga, core training, etc. You are rewarded for completing X number of workouts by receiving new areas to work out in and new music to work out to. You create a personal profile, and the game will gauge your fitness progress and make recommendations." Chris, have you ever heard of that? And do you have any comments about it?
Absolutely. We love it. And another big trend is what they call the peripherals, the things you plug in to your game console that aren't just the regular controllers. And, you know, it started with that sort of workout equipment is one of them. Another example is a game called Dance Dance Revolution, where you have a mat and you sort of have to follow the you know, the cues on the screen to sort of place your foot in the right place.
Tell me it's not done by Arthur Murray, I hope.
It's not done very well by me either, but it's great fun and great exercise. And then the coolest one, I think, last year was Sony came out with one called iToy, which is a camera. And so rather than controlling the video game with your thumbs, you just move your hands. The camera watches you, and you can kind of, you know, you start with little simple things like poking balloons and then chasing people, and then you're sort of jumping around like a lunatic in the room with the game, you know, watching you. But it is good fun. And the one we're playing right now has got bongo drums, where it's like Dance Dance Revolution, but you have to hit bongo drums to the beat. And I'm terrible at that as well.
That's a picture I would really like to see. But we have to take a break right now. We're talking about how video games are definitely not just for kids anymore, although we kind of sound like kids when we're talking about them. We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us an email. That address is totn@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We're talking about how video games and video game players have grown up. Our guest is Chris Anderson, editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. How serious are you about playing video games? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Chris, one quick question before we go to the calls, and that is, in the old days, you know, it used to be that for the really great graphics, you had to go to the video game parlor and put the quarters in the slot. Obviously, that's all changed. But is there any difference in the quality of the game between what you get on a PC and what you get on Xbox or PlayStation or something like that?
There's an interesting leapfrog that goes between the two. It used to be that the PC was kind of the gold standard of graphics. Well, actually, the arcade was the gold standard, and the PC was the best for that. And then with the Sony PlayStation series, and now with the Xbox, basically every 3 or 4 years they release a new generation, and it sort of defines a kind of graphics standard that's better than what's in the PCs. And then the PCs very quickly catch up. And what's interesting about the PCs. The PC side of it is that now games are driving development on PCs. You know, these days, you know, basically they're good enough to do Word and Excel and, you know, email and web browsing. But games are so demanding that, you know, practically the only reason to upgrade every few years, upgrade your PC, is to be able to play things like Half-Life 2, which are more demanding, more rewarding, and really push the hardware to the limit.
Another sign that video games have grown up is the level of reality and the subject matter and language in the games. One of the latest crazes in video games is the popularity of gangsta video games like Grand Theft Auto, a carjacking adventure game where the player takes on life in the hood. Oscar-nominated filmmaker John Singleton joins us now. He's best known as the director and writer of the film Boys in the Hood. He's presently working on a video game with Snoop Dogg called Fear and Respect. He joins us by cell phone from Hollywood. Welcome to the program.
All right, thank you.
So just like in music, gangsta and hip-hop culture is making its way into video games, how would you describe Fear and Respect?
Well, our game is different from, you know, GTA or the other games, what I call like the urban explosion in games, in that, you know, I'm involved and then Snoop is involved. I mean, I wrote and directed this game. It's kind of reminiscent of... kind of like what I would do in terms of a film, you know, but there's multiple parameters. The game Fear and Respect, as it's called, it's called as such because the character gets out of jail and, you know, depending on the gameplay, there's 2 meters, one for fear and one for respect on the streets. And depending on how you play the game and what you do in the game, those meters, you know, those meters go up or down or whatever, and it dictates what happens in the game.
What does it mean?
And it's, you know, it's not one of those games that you can just go around and just shoot everybody in the whole game and, you know, have a self-destructive time. I mean, you can do that, but there are consequences for it. Just as there are consequences in life, such as, you know, if you go and shoot certain people in our game, your family is adversely affected.
What does it mean to direct a game? What does that? How does that differ from directing a movie?
Well, for me, what it means is that, you know, in film, you know, you have a linear storyline. You have a set, you know, you have a set plot, and you know pretty much where the character's going to go, and the ending is always the same as you watch the movie over and over again. In a video game, you don't have to do that. You could have multiple endings. You could have multiple parameters. So actually, the gamer is dictating where the story is going.
I see. And are there actors, or are these computer generated characters?
They're computer generated characters.
I see.
So I mean, Snoop, you know, does the voiceover and the motion capture and everything, and then we have various actors from movies, you know, doing that also. But it's all CG, you know, computer generated.
So do you have any concerns that the popularity of gangsta games could reinforce negative stereotypes? Do you worry about that?
No, I don't worry about that. I mean, well, you know, it's the same. The same considerations come in terms of when you make a picture. I mean, I wouldn't have gotten involved in the gaming process if I didn't think that I could take it to another level. And I do think that with this game, we're taking it to another level. Like I said, you know, with this game, it's not simply a guy running around shooting people, you know, for a visceral kind of, you know. you know, street experience. I mean, you know, in our game, you know, if you spare someone, you know, there's consequences for it. If you shoot someone, you know, out of anger, you know, your family can be adversely affected, you know.
Huh. So, but are you saying that there is a social message, or is it just, you know, the life and consequences of this living
on
the street?
I wouldn't go and say that. It's entertainment value, but, you know, everything I do has some kind of context to it, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know,
and
I think it would be bad for me to just say, oh, you know, you're going to play this game, you're going to get a social message to it. I mean,
I didn't mean to use the term as saying, you know, you're trying to lecture people, but I'm wondering if, you know, as an artist, you're trying to raise consciousness in some way, you know, more than just, as you say, more than just have a shoot 'em up kind of a game. But
one thing that was really important in making this game was to try to do something that basically was urban, but like what we say, the difference between a hip hop album that was, you know, produced by people who were just interested in whatever, you know, and people who were actually from the streets.
Okay. Just one final question. I mean, kids are going to get their hands on these kinds of games. Does that trouble you at all?
Well, what troubles me more is people. People, and the same consideration go into the movie in terms of the movie audiences, are people who basically have no hand in policing their own children and what their own children do. I mean, most of the guys that are playing these games now, there are kids that play these games, but there's a rating system for the games. There's a lot of guys in their 20s and 30s, you know, and adults that play these video games. So it's just like when you make a rated R movie, you know, yeah, there are going to be some kids that go and see the rated R movie because it's a cool movie at the moment, but there's a rating system in place, you know.
Got it. All right,
and
John.
And it's not our jobs as artists to, like, you know, to police that. Jobs for parents to, like, to raise their kids, you know.
I got it. No, I appreciate the distinction. All right. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay.
Filmmaker John Singleton, who wrote and directed the film Boys in the Hood. He's also the creator and director of the Snoop video game called Fear and Respect, due out soon. He joined us by phone from California, and still talking with me from the studios of KQED in San Francisco is Christopher Anderson, the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. And Chris, I'm just going to take a call now. Maybe you can help me answer. This is from Mark. Mark in St. Louis, Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks a lot.
I'm
enjoying the show. I just wanted to comment. I'm not heavy into the video games. I mean, I got left behind at, like, Zelda. Even my 12-year-old is better at this stuff than I am, so I just have kind of given up trying. But my oldest son, who just turned 24, is one of the people who bought Halo 2, and he was actually called by a couple of different video game stores two or three times before the game came, a couple of weeks before the game came out. I've never seen anything like marketing like this.
Interesting. So, Chris Anderson, has this been Microsoft been pushing really hard on this?
Absolutely. You know, Microsoft got into the video game business with the Xbox 2.5-3 years ago, and they were up against very entrenched competition with Sony, and they needed a killer game. Oh, so that's probably the wrong phrase. They needed a compelling game. They needed a game that would make the platform, make you want to buy an Xbox. And fortunately, you know, they bought the studio that made Halo, and Halo turned out to be that. It was really, you know, a reason enough to buy the Xbox. They now need to not just sort of, you know, get a foothold in the industry, but actually to start making money. And so they desperately needed Halo 2 to be, you know, even more successful and even more of a reason to buy an Xbox and cement their position. So they put a lot of weight behind it. I think it paid off for them. I mean, you often see a lot of marketing behind games that are disappointments. This was one where, because the studio is just got such a great team and such a reputation for quality, They took their time. They did it right. I think it did $125 million in its first day, which is a record for any form of entertainment.
Amazing. Let's take one more call. Jay in Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I just have a comment to make about a PlayStation 2 game I'm currently been sinking a lot of my time into. It's a cute little Japanese game called Katamari Damashi, and the basic premise of it is you're this little guy, and you have a ball, and you're rolling it around someone's house or around town, picking things up, and getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And as time goes on, you start up picking up little things like postage stamps and chocolates, and eventually you're picking up mice and then cats and people and cars and buildings, and it just gets bigger and bigger. And it's a really cute, cartoony game that I think is fun, innovative, and nonviolent. And I'm not against violent video games. I'm a big fan of games like Doom and so forth, but I think it's a good alternative to some of the really violent games out there.
Jay, thanks for that. What's it called again?
Katamari Damashi.
Katamari Damashi. Okay, thank you for calling. Chris Anderson, you ever hear of that?
Absolutely. It raises a really good point. First of all, it's a truly innovative, I mean, almost even alien game. It kind of came out of nowhere. Such an interesting idea of sort of rolling around, picking up stuff. And I've watched some of my colleagues play it. And it raises a kind of one of the big questions in the game industry is, you know, are we stuck, you know, stuck in sequelitis? You know, the same kind of forms, just kind of better and better graphics, better quality, but really, you know, not that much innovation. And as a result, not that much, you know, funner, not, you know, possibly even losing some of the kind of joy of, you know, pure gameplay that we saw in the early days. And the Japanese have proved, you know, innovative in a way that we haven't really done here, in finding kind of totally out of left field ways to kind of bring fun back into gaming. I don't know how they do it, but they continue to generate these things that are just kind of dropped out of nowhere.
Well, you know, as people spend more and more time playing with these games and they get violent, or some of them get clever, there's still questions about whether playing them is a good thing. As a parent, we were always trying to figure out whether we should be letting our children do that or reading a book or something else. And joining us now is Sherry Turkle. She's a professor of social studies of science and technology at MIT, and she's been studying computer culture and games for 20 years and is the author of Life on the Screen, Identity in the Age of the Internet. She joins us now from her home in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
So, you know, I suppose, as you know, maybe there's no simple answer. I'm sure there's no simple answer, but is there any way to judge whether these video games are good or bad for us?
Well, I think the point is not that they're good or bad. I think that they're powerful, and they're very different in their effects on different kinds of people. For example, if you're a loner and yet you don't want to be alone, games can offer you the illusion of companionship without the threat of intimacy. They can offer you the promise of living in a kind of perfect micro-world. They can offer you a place where things are clean and there are no messy rules. It can be very compelling for a certain kind of person in a way that can bring them out of the flow of life sometimes. And that happens. On the other hand, there are some people who start to play a game like The Sims or The Sims Online, a game where you create a character and build a character and form a parallel life. A little bit like being a god, says my daughter. You get a chance to work through issues or to act out issues. Some kids construct families that are like their families and get a chance to do things differently in the new families they create. Some kids get a chance to take their greatest fear and live it out in the game. In other words, it's very constructive. So I think that I think you raised the issue of parents and how to think about it. I think that with the game form, as with all forms, you have to know your kid, you have to know the game, you have to look carefully at the match and really say what's happening, see what's happening, because, you know, people are always talking about the games being addictive like a drug, and I think it's a terrible analogy for parents because, you know, if your kid's on heroin, the only thing you need to do, not just the first thing, is you have to get that kid off heroin. If a child is with a video game, the question is, what you need to know is, what are they doing with it? You know, what kind of imaginary play are they creating? You know, what does it mean to the child? So I see the games less like a narcotic and more like a Rorschach. I mean, more like something that tells you what's going on with your child and you can kind of work with them and understand them.
Interesting. We're talking with Sherry Turkle. She's a professor of social studies of science and technology at MIT, and Christopher Anderson. He's editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Sherry Turkle, I just want to get to this question of, you know, this is a big, I mean, it's a big industry, $10 billion, and there's a lot of money involved here. But what kind of scientific research is there really on the effects of these games. You've described some of their positive and negative values, but is there anybody who's trying to study this in a systematic way, or doesn't it lend itself to that?
Well, there's a lot of study, but the trouble is that we really can't completely factor out. I mean, there certainly are compelling studies as well as anecdotal and clinical evidence on both sides, but we really can't figure out, as we've had trouble figuring out with television over 50 years, a kind of definitive effect on all people. So I think that for the moment, it seems to me that even people who systematically observe the games are best left with looking specifically at games and, you know, particularly vulnerable children or stages of development. I mean, there is no question that playing a violent video game that degrades women and has them in the roles of whores or bimbos, and degrades men and has them in the roles of pimps or thieves. You know, it's not a game that, you know, common sense would suggest is a kind of a constructive place to work through issues.
Got it.
And, you know, the studies show that, and the common sense shows that. On the other hand, that's not the entire industry, and there's a lot about this field, and I loved the point about, you know, we need to reinvent gaming and bring it back to its very exciting roots. There's a lot in this field that offers tremendous potential for people to grow and change.
We have time for one quick call. Let's go to Brett in Sacramento, California. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
My question was for Chris. Chris, you had mentioned, you know, playing the game with your 7-year-old, and I was one of those. I'm in my mid-20s, but I was there in line, you know, midnight the day of. So I find myself, you know, really getting into it. But, you know, the question I had was about the rating system. And I know this game is rated teen, which is a 17 and above, if I'm not mistaken. And I wanted to find out what your opinion was on that, being that you've played it, if you really thought that.
Okay, Brett, I'm gonna have to cut you off there and get Chris's answer because we're almost out of time. So thanks for the question. Is the rating system adequate, Chris Anderson?
Well, it's you need to actually know what it means. This is controversial, and not all parents agree with me. In this case, they do a couple things. First of all, you're not killing humans; you're killing aliens, imaginary fantasy creatures. Secondly, I always do it with him. He doesn't play on his own. And thirdly, I kind of go with the Lego rule. Lego had a rule that they would have no 20th century weapons. So you could have swords, you could have laser cannons, but no 20th century weapons. In other words, it divorces it from, you know, from the world they see elsewhere. And that's what Halo does as well.
Chris, I just want to stop you there and say thank you. And I guess, Sherry Turkle, any thoughts quickly on the rating system? Brief.
Yeah, I think I probably think it's more problematic than Chris, because I think that with Lego, there's a kind of limited amount of damage you could do in the Lego world. I think that the amount of
I really do have to stop you there.
Can be pretty heavy.
Sherry Turkle is a professor of social studies at MIT, and Chris Anderson is editor-in-chief of Wired. When we come back, we'll talk with pianist Leon Fleischer. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.